Hey everybody, we back, brand new Techish in the house. It's Michael Behane and I'm with
Abidesi Osuntade, since we're saying our last name.
Yeah, I will say my last name. Too many Michaels. This is actually the first time we've recorded in the flesh, actually, for like this whole new batch of episodes that we've done in 2020.
Wow.
It's all been internet, and you never knew. The audience never knew.
Ooh,
seamless.
Behind the scenes. Yes, shout out Google for Startups for hosting us today.
Yep, we're recording in Google Campus, right? This is what it's called, Google for Startups Campus. They've given us a free podcast space, so if you're interested in recording your pod, come down here. Shout out to them.
I think they rebranded
Google for Startups. So the first story I want to talk about is apparently Jeff Bezos now, breaking news, has committed $10 billion to climate change, which is apparently 8% of his net worth. Abidesi,
wow.
Are you going to join him and also give 8%
now, right?
Of the net worth?
Yeah. I saw that dick pic. This is crazy because I feel like every time Jeff Bezos does something on the personal PR front, he's doing it to distract from Amazon's negative PR.
Right, yeah.
And it's hard not to remember that he's also been in the news recently, again, over conditions in the Amazon fulfillment centers.
Right, yeah.
So it's one of those things where I do feel that I can't pretend as an Amazon Prime customer and regular Amazon customer, I can't pretend that a big part of climate change is also caused by Amazon's
100%.
Existence
yeah.
and supply chain. So there's something that's a bit hard to, I don't know, like wrap my head around.
Right.
The idea that, like, I can't fathom the amount
of impact
that this will have versus the cost that Amazon's creating. Does that make
sense?
Oh,
right. No, I get you. Yeah. I think I've heard or read about how there are like an internal group within Amazon. Like, I think they call it like Amazon for Climate Change Justice employees, and they're kind of really trying to push the company. But I don't think to no avail. I think they even accused Amazon of like funding think tanks that are kind of climate change deniers and stuff like that. So it's real dark. But I mean, end of the day, 8% of his net worth, $10 billion. I struggle to be critical of somebody who's just put down $10 billion. I'm not going to lie.
Well, I mean, after $5 billion, do you notice the difference?
Yeah. I mean, some people were saying, oh, like, do you put 8% of your net worth? But it's not the same. Like, if your net worth is 50K and you put 8%, you're going to feel that. But
if you still have student loan debts,
you
need to focus on paying that off. But yeah, I don't know. I just think there must be some amount of billions at which point additional billions are
doesn't
just
think.
Meaningless.
I mean, listen, he got divorced and I think he lost half of his wealth and he didn't blink. Like,
well,
he just kept it moving. So obviously, I think you're
sending
right.
Those dick pics out.
Once you've got 100 billion, I think.
Never forget. Sorry. go on.
Once you've got 100 billion, I think like 50 billion, what difference does it make? You're never going to be able to spend all of it. But
it's impressive. What if this encourages more billionaires?
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm thinking of some, you know, former Nigerian dictators. You know, maybe everyone else is going to start stepping up.
You know what, though? I think we talked about this off mic. How much of an impact do you think all of the kind of negative attention he's had recently regarding the fact that he's not been so philanthropic, the fact that, you know, the negative press that Amazon has got in general, like in a vacuum, this probably wouldn't happen, right? As in, is this a victory for those people that kind of pushed him and been like, oh, what's Jeff Bezos doing? Like, blah, 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 blah. That he's now been forced to kind of place hand and say, okay, I've got to do something that looks good.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a victory for those people?
I definitely do. I mean, it's a victory for the whole world.
Victory for Twitter as well.
Twitter, everyone. I mean, I can't afford to solve climate change, but if he wants to put a few billies into it, I'm all down for that. But I think you're absolutely right. You know, we can't pretend that an act like this happens in isolation when ultimately, you know, his net worth is also tied to our perception of his companies. Mm. And our perception of the role that they play. You know, like, we've watched Facebook on a downward spiral of toxic branding over the last few months. And for people who are listening in the US versus people in the UK, you know, in the US, Amazon has a much stronger brand reputation than here in the UK. Because here in the UK, everyone knows about the fulfillment center conditions because it was like, every year around Christmas, The Guardian put that on the cover.
Right.
Everyone's talking about it. In America, people are just like, whatevs.
Right.
It's really not a big deal. Like, Amazon is a trusted household brand name.
You think so?
And yeah, it really is. It is. I mean, like, hashtag techish for people who are listening to join in. But I used to work for Amazon. And this was something that we talked about a lot in the company. And something that I really noticed when I would be in the Seattle office versus the offices here in the UK.
Hold on. So in the offices in the US, they would say, we've actually got a much better, like, brand perception here than we do in the UK.
Yeah, because I was B2B.
Got you.
So I was in a B2B team and I was in a client-facing role.
What time frame is this again?
This is 2014.
2014, okay, it's quite recent. Yeah. Damn. Okay, yeah, and recently
was, there. Sometimes when we would negotiate with clients, you know, they would, in the UK, bring that up as a talking point. Wow. Like, oh, you know, some of our end users are concerned about XYZ. But when I talk to my peers in the US, they'd be like, oh, nah, no one cares about that here. Like, everyone loves Amazon.
It's the Wild West in the States. I guess. Yeah. It's capitalism. Like, they just expect companies to just be like, yeah, that's capitalism. We move.
Yeah. But I do think, you know, we're starting to understand a bit about how perception informs reality. Some people say perception is reality. And every time something like this happens, I always try and think about what it might be distracting me from.
Right.
And I think that just backs up your point that there are a lot of people doing positive things, not purely solely driven by the need to do something positive. Sometimes it's connected to something else.
Let me push back on something. So, you know, the whole concept of like toxic brand, you mentioned Facebook, you mentioned Amazon. Is there a chance that we're looking at intelligentsia level, like as in we're looking at people on Twitter, the journalists, the kind of thought leaders? But even in the UK, if you spoke to the average person on the street and asked them about Facebook, they're going to be like, yeah, talk to my nan. Or and the average person who uses Amazon, they're like, yeah, next day delivery, amazing. Yeah. And that it's a lot of it is we're in an echo chamber where we talk to like-minded people who work in the industry. It's very much an insider's, you know, who's who. And like, oh, look at this, you know, Rico Decode, look what they're saying here. And like, is there a chance that we're missing the actual, we're not in touch with the masses, basically?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking this recently. You know, I'm throwing shade, but at the same time, I said I'm an Amazon Prime customer. Yeah. I'm happily
sell using out. It
there. Hey, man.
I'm sell out
capitalism
too.
Is complex. Capitalism is complex. Same kind of thing with Facebook. Like, yes, I watched the Cambridge Analytica scandal unfold, but I'm still using WhatsApp and Instagram. So, you know, love those products, love the teams. But yeah, I think it's so difficult for us as techies and fans of tech and like fans of products to try to understand what it's like to process this information when you're not as involved. Like, I recently switched browser. I was like, okay, I'm gonna leave Chrome, I'm gonna switch to Brave, I'm gonna use a password manager, blah blah blah. I was talking to my friends about it at the pub and they're like, what's Brave?
Right.
What's a password manager? And I was like, wow.
Do you think they would have heard of Firefox though? Because I switched to Firefox. Because I'm trying to do the challenge of like, how long can I go without using Google products, right? I mean, we just praise them for letting us use their podcast studio, right?
But it's a big machine,
right? Okay, cool, interesting.
What would you stop using Gmail for your company?
I don't
emails?
Use Gmail. That's the thing.
Interesting.
I don't use Gmail.
And what email server do you use?
So I use just the default Apple mail service.
But what about the actual exchange?
So I use it's hosted on my web hoster, and then I connect it to my Apple Mail, and that's it. I don't use Gmail. That's I think I'm missing out because I think there's a lot of like productivity plugins and stuff like that I miss out when I use Gmail. The Apple Mail product software is kind of crap, to be honest. But I've never been in the Gmail ecosystem like that. And the annoying thing I find about Gmail, as somebody who does email marketing, and I know people might say, well, serves you right, you're an email marketer, is that if you do, Gmail will now funnel a lot of your email marketing into a different tab and really destroy your open rate if your email looks a certain way according to their algorithm. And I realized a few times like what is like the key point to like where it changes to different tabs. And I saw someone tweet, they were like, wow, my email went from like 40% open rates to like 10% open rates.
Wow.
What happened? And I felt bad. I was like, okay, have you tried this? Maybe you're using too many images. That's one thing, for example. And it concerns me when email, which is like this open platform, which is not like social media, which is why people, a lot of marketers love email, is now kind of being dominated by one email platform. So now they can kind of determine what works, what doesn't. And maybe pretty soon they'll be like, well, pay us if you want to get into the main tab, right?
So that's anyways, messed up.
Yeah, it's messed up. Anyways.
But yeah, one thing I'd just love to hear what folks think about Jeff Bezos' commitment to climate change. Because I feel like I'm always hypercritical and cynical, but you know.
A hater. all right, cool. So, okay, this is another very serious topic. Apparently, Apple's come out and said that, you know what, the coronavirus, and we haven't talked about this at all in Turkish, will now start to hurt iPhone supplies. So there will be an iPhone supply shortage.
Hashtag first world problems.
Hashtag first world problems indeed, because I think a lot of Chinese factories are going to be shut down. There's even a drop in sales in China as well, just because of all the stores that are closing down and whatnot. So just in general, do you think this whole thing is overhyped or do you think it's underhyped? I see a lot of VCs that seem to be tweeting about how, you know, dangerous this is.
Yeah. Someone on Twitter was saying it could be one of those black swan moments.
That's what I was going to say. I think on VCs are very much always thinking in a way. Explain what black swan is. Do you know, like?
I didn't actually read the book. Nassim Taleb.
Right. So I'll try.
You tell me. You read him. You like him.
So a black swan event essentially is, it's based on the kind of anecdote story how we thought that all swans were white until we saw a black swan. Right. So a black swan event has become a shorthand for an event that's unlikely but has massive consequences. I don't know how it even links to the idea of a black swan.
So it's basically about a recession in China. So the Chinese economy has obviously been growing really fast and performing really well. Right. And now suddenly we have a possibility of all of that economic development being derailed by coronavirus.
Not necessarily
and that could have like global impact, right?
It's not even necessarily that. They're worried about it actually being a pandemic and actually being like millions of people dying. If you remember the Spanish flu, I mean, I can't say if you remember the Spanish flu.
How old do you think I am?
We old. I think Spanish flu was in 1918, and I think there was like some crazy amount of people that died. Millions. Like, we would be flabbergasted if we actually looked at the data.
Wow.
So when they say, when VCs are like, oh, it's a black swan event, they're basically saying, could it be something that is repeated in 2020? Right. We're a much more globalized world. We have flights. We're much more connected. Everything is manufactured overseas and then shipped all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they're right that we should be worried. I mean, what can we do really anyway? Apart from wash our hands, that's about it. That's it. I'm keeping it real.
Keep it simple. Wear that SARS mask.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we're just in a world of unknowns. And if anyone reads Bloomberg Business Week, they did a really good summary of, you know, what is coronavirus and why, what are pandemics and, you know, are we prepared to deal with them? And the short answer is no. Yeah. And a lot of the experts in the world are saying we need to treat the war on germs like we do war on terrorism or any other thing that we're investing big defense budgets into.
Right.
Because the truth is we don't see these pathogens or whatever they are as a real enemy. And so we're not having a concerted global effort to overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
Something like 70% of all of these viruses that have happened over the last decade, from, you know, coronavirus SARS. To SARS, have originated from animals.
Yeah.
So we actually know a lot about the source of them. But despite that, we still have a lot of, you know, wet markets all around the world. I've been to a lot myself. And
what's a wet market? Is it like a place where you sell animals?
Yeah,
food?
It's literally where you can just walk around and there'll just be like raw meat, raw fish.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have raw meat that could have bugs in it.
Right.
Coming into contact with people.
And
that's typically how they spread, unless you start reading the conspiracies, which say they've been grown in the labs.
CIA.
That's for the next one.
CIA.
But yeah, I just think it's, you know, I'm starting to now understand a bit more about, you know, what are the risks to humanity if we don't, you know, put more funding into solving these diseases. And like, to be honest, I never heard about a political party standing up and being like, yo, we're going to pledge X amount of money to help us get better at fighting pandemics, because it's just not sexy. It's not fun.
It's not even just sexy. It's like an unseen thing.
Yeah, exactly.
There's so many problems that we can see in front of us, you know, homelessness, whatever, right? To invest capital, or significant amount of capital, into a thing that might happen one day down the line that we can't see. It's a flaw in human thinking. And that's why these black swan events happen, because nobody is thinking that far down the road about a rare one-off event that may or may not happen. And when it does happen, you're caught unprepared.
But it will happen. That's the point.
Eventually, right.
Yeah. That's, I think, the point that people are making. And I think you're absolutely right. If we could blow it up and watch it, watch the mushroom cloud, that would be really fun. But
think about
it,
like, we all know that recessions happen, that there are economic booms, economic busts.
Where are you, recession?
Yeah, and it's like,
where are you?
But I guarantee you, when the next one happens, most people will still be caught unawares and unprepared.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of people.
This one's overdue, though.
No, but when you chat to the average person, who's there thinking, oh my God, the next recession? Everyone's thinking, I got my job, I'm doing all right, are good, I'm going on holiday. No one's here like, yo, we need to put our money away. The average person, right? Maybe hedge fund managers are hedging against it, right? And that's the same thinking, as in like, I can't see the problem down the line, even though I know maybe it might happen one day. I'm not going to worry about it.
What other big companies in tech could potentially be affected by disruption in China? Go.
If you want to make some monies, I'm not a financial advisor, but this might be a time to buy Zoom stock.
Oh.
So the behavior that people are now showing is that more times than not, it's going to increase remote work, most likely, because a lot of chances of hatching these diseases through commuting. I've seen a lot of conferences that are now being shut down. So a lot of conferences are not happening. Because that's a fantastic environment to spread a disease.
That's true, actually.
Right. So now you're going to see a lot, all the technology that enable remote work, remote conferencing, like it might be time to buy Zoom. That's all I'm going to say. So, so some companies will benefit. Some companies, it's not just everything will decline. Some companies will actually benefit.
I heard from the Twitterverse that wig supplies are already short.
Why?
Because people get wigs on Alibaba. So a lot of the, you know, black hairstylists over here in the Western world been using Chinese suppliers, and
it might be great. It might be great for factories in the West, because now it might make sense to supply it, to get your local supplier locally, right?
Dust off that machinery.
Yeah, dust off that machinery. Wow, interesting times.
No surprises on this one, but HQ Trivia, the once obsessive game that everyone was all over, is dead. Is no more.
Aww.
Are you sad? Did you win anything?
I never played it once.
You never played?
Did you play?
Of course I played, man.
Did you win?
Never. Honestly, the thing was quite buggy. I always crashed. So HQ Trivia was a game where you could win real money. It was really fun. It was a quiz show. So they had a set time, like every day, where you'd basically open up your app, log on. And it was a bit like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Like one of those things where you have to consistently answer with the correct answer.
Live.
Otherwise, you get booted out. And yeah, it was live. There was a host, a really entertaining host. It was cool. It was just like bringing all the fun of like the game shows we grew up watching as kids on telly in the evening, bringing that to a real life mobile experience. And I think there were times where probably most tech offices around the world had people logging in and, you know, beyond the tech world as well. But they weren't without their fair share of controversy. Their iconic host was sort of pulled up into a very public battle with the founder after some information leaked about him doing interviews with just like other big media outlets.
Wow.
And someone died. One of the co-founders
passed away, didn't they?
Committed suicide. Oh, well, like, we're still waiting to find out. I think it's still in court, but potentially died of an overdose. They finally called it quits. So they tried a few different ways to monetize. They did some partnerships with sports companies.
Right.
Thought about maybe like gamifying, just watching a match and like creating specialized content for corporate partners. But yeah, they have not found a way to survive. And now they are no more.
Apparently, the final HQ Trivia, the hosts got drunk and they started saying, like, give me a job. And they started spraying champagne and just saying all kinds of
Wow. Yeah. I wish I saw that.
Yeah, you can find it on YouTube. I'll put the link in the show notes. That's hilarious. And I think there's a team of 25. So it's obviously not nice when people lose their jobs. And I think they were burning from what I can see in the TechCrunch article, they were burning for $1 million a month. I think just in prizes. So I think
that's a high burn rate.
Yeah, I mean, I think to be honest, I don't know. I mean, if you'd give me this business plan, I know that it had a lot of traffic and attention, but I would have been like, so hold on, our business model is that we give away money. Yes. Okay, cool. So how are we going to somehow survive, and figure out how to monetize this in a way that's sustainable? And the sad thing is, if you're the co-founder or one of the originators of this idea, is that this will happen again. Somebody will make this work because the idea is ingenious. Somebody down the line will do a HQ Trivia that actually succeeds and is scalable. It might be a big entity, it might not necessarily be a startup, but the actual model was like so creative.
But how do you scale up that incentivization structure if you're literally paying to participate? You're paying people to participate.
Not necessarily.
I feel like you get quite... But there's always the incentive for folks to join because they feel they can win the game.
So I think I would have thought, how do we, instead of giving away cash, how do we do giveaways where we're working with corporations to give away their products, their stock, whatever, right? And have them pay us essentially and do partnerships. I mean, I guess that's what they were trying to do, you know? But once you start off with a cash prize, it's very difficult to say, we're not doing cash prize, we're giving away Nikes. It's like, well, I want the cash. So, right, so it's difficult. But somebody will figure it out. I think it's a really ingenious idea. And not every startup's going to work. Sometimes certain startups are just there to kind of push the culture forward and push ideas forward and whatever. And that's a victory in itself.
At the forefront of innovation.
Not my startup, though. We're going to win.
Yeah.
I was like that.
So, Michael, have you seen Parasite?
I haven't.
How have you not seen this movie?
Yeah, I know. I'm slipping. Go on. Tell me about Parasite.
So... I don't want to give away any spoilers for folks who haven't watched it yet. But if you haven't, please go watch this film. It's incredible. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes Film Festival, won the Best Picture Award at the Oscars, beating Sam Mendes' 1917, the hotly anticipated winner, directed by Korean director Bong Joon-ho. It's actually not his first big film. Apparently he's done many, many more, but we just don't know about them in the West because we're ignorant. But yes, yeah, so this is an incredible film. I had the pleasure of watching at the Barbican Cinema last week. And it's called Parasite. And you might be wondering why it's called Parasite. It's not a horror film per se. It's actually a genre-bending film. It's got comedy, drama, suspense, thriller. And like London and lots of the cities you're listening from all over the world, Johannesburg, New York, San Francisco, Seoul, Korea, where this film is based, has a huge gap in terms of wealth between the richest and the poorest.
Right.
And the film is about two very different families. One is a poor family, lives in a basement in a low-income area. They are talking about how everyone in the country is overqualified, there aren't enough jobs. Meanwhile, you have a very wealthy, affluent family living high up in the hills in this beautiful mansion who can afford to give their children everything their hearts desire. And over the course of the film, their lives are contrasted in really interesting ways. But the reason why I feel the film has done so well is because it's so timely. You know, it's bringing into a very entertaining medium a way to talk about rich versus poor, us versus them. And a lot of critically acclaimed films and really popular films have sort of have done that quite well in the last few years. But it's also just a really gripping storyline. Like from the beginning, you're really like, okay, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And it's also very, very beautifully shot.
So it's a good film with a message.
It absolutely does have a message.
What did you take away from it though?
I think for me, one of the things I took away, it was really interesting. There's a scene where the brother, where the son says to his dad, "Oh, dad, you said you have a plan. What's the plan?" And his dad kind of sighs and he's like, "Yeah, I have no plan." And he's like, "The best plan is no plan, because when you plan for something, something always goes wrong. So it's better just not have a plan." And I just thought that was really interesting because I'm probably the complete opposite of that mindset. But there is something kind of stoic about the fact that, you know, you can't plan for everything and something will always go wrong. But yeah, I think my takeaway from it was that we're more similar than we are different.
Right.
You know, I've only been to Seoul once in my whole life, but everything that happened and the interactions between the families, within the families, was incredibly relatable.
And what does it say, though, about, you know, that gap between rich and poor? Like, is there kind of, does it lean in one way? Is it kind of saying, this is horrible, it has to be changed? Or was it open to interpretation? Or like,
I think ultimately the message is just a reminder of the injustice of the world.
Right.
You know, there is like a kind of like fantasy sequence where one of the people in the poor family dreams of getting a job and, you know, being rich enough to like live in a house like that one day. But of course it never happens. And I think it is very important for us to watch those films and remember that a lot of the stories that capitalism is selling us are lies and not true.
Okay.
Like that was kind of my takeaway, because I feel that, let's say America, for example, you know, where I was born, I lived for my first few formative years. We get so caught up in this idea of an American dream. But if you actually look at the evidence, and you know, we've talked about some of these things on the show before, generational wealth amongst different races, amongst different classes, it's hard to find like enough data to make me believe that that dream is real
right.
And that dream can be accessed by everybody.
Right.
The fact is, whatever amount of capital your parents can amass before you're born and then give to you in the course of your life is probably a larger indicator of how wealthy you're going to be than anything else.
Completely. No, you're right.
And when I watched that, I was just like, oh man, like, depressing. I can work all I want and I can have 5, 10, 15 jobs. Like, you know, I can stop sleeping. But it's still going to be really hard for me to catch up to people who were just born with a silver spoon in their mouth and who, you know, whose parents could give them that help up that no amount of time and years that I work will ever catch me up to.
Right.
So I thought that was kind of interesting, because I think we do need to have honest conversations like that with each other.
I think we're having those conversations now.
Exactly.
I think this podcast, we don't lie and say, oh, everyone can make it, whatever. Like,
I think what I mean in terms of wider society, at the beginning of the show, you said, are we in our echo chamber of, you know, other, you know, intellectuals who want to discuss these things at length? And like, okay, fine, we are. But what's great about having a film like that is that people go out and see it and people start having these conversations at home.
So I saw a tweet And I want to discuss it with you, Abba. So it's from someone called Amanda Goetz. I think I've done her surname injustice there, but I'll read the tweet regardless. In 2011, I was a female founder and couldn't raise nor find anyone to help me. Now it's almost impossible as a mum to take the capital risk / salary hit to be a founder again. I miss building 0 to 1, but likely won't ever get the chance. Any other women / mums experience something similar? So just to clarify, I miss building 0 to 1. 0 to 1 is a phrase that Peter Thiel, the famous venture capitalist. Yeah. He had a book called 0 to 1, which basically said that going from 1 to 2 would be if I did like an iterative idea. If I just like, I'm going to do my own version of Nike. It's not original. It's just based on what's already been done. 0 to 1 is more along the lines of I'm building something brand new that's never been done. It's a whole new startup. It's a whole new category. It's something amazing. And this is where like massive wealth gets built. So she's saying I missed my chance to build a startup that of that kind of magnitude. And she's asking other women, such mothers, like, what's your experience with that? Like, does that ring true? Like, is that a fear of yours, perhaps? Like, just being completely transparent?
I often think about how, I mean, I'm not a mom yet, but yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's hard enough for women to get funding as it is with all of the structural challenges that we've spoken about before. And also just, you know, misogyny, patriarchy, double standards, even harder for black women. And I'm sure black, disabled, Muslim, everything else women. And the whole idea of capital risk when you have dependents is something I can't even imagine, to be honest. Like, you know, I bootstrapped, I tried to raise funding, I realized maybe it wasn't the right time and then maybe it wasn't the right decision. But all the while, I was consulting, freelancing, I was a guest lecturer, I was on that grind and I was just trying to make my ends meet.
Right.
Now, once you bring a person into this world, I mean, we were just talking about that, everything you do is either contributing to or taking away from your friends, your child's future.
Completely.
Right? So if I've got, you know, 15K in my savings and I decide to put that into an MVP or a prototype, that's 15K less than I can spend on my kid's education.
Absolutely.
And so I totally understand where she's coming from. And this kind of goes back to what we were saying before as well about how the rise of entrepreneurship is actually not rising. It's falling. Completely. Because where do you go to access capital when you aren't trying to necessarily build the next unicorn company, but you just want to build a company and, you know, you need some cash to do that. I feel like it's not easy to find out what the options are out there. And I do think, yeah, it's difficult, you know, single mom, single parent, you know, it's not just your money anymore. And maybe it's a reminder that entrepreneurship is a privilege.
It completely is, yeah.
You know, it's a privilege. I know we're in that hustle culture, Gary Vee, Battle of the Apps, Shark Tank, Dragon's Den, watching people do the founder life like it's just any other job. Like, ooh, I'm going to be a teacher. Ooh, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. No.
Do you think also, like, there was this thing where it was counterintuitive to tell a young person to start a company? Like, historically, young people weren't entrepreneurs in that way. It was like the old person. But then with tech game, it was like, okay, start a company when you're young. Was it primarily actually because of the fact that actually as you get older, it gets too difficult probably, to be honest, and that maybe there is a runway where from age of like 21 to like whatever limit you want to cut it off at, that's the optimal time to try something that kind of risk, because it's like, yo, you're not going to really be able to take those kind of risks in the future. You can, but
you won't have the energy.
You won't have the energy, right? To do a startup at least. And what I mean by startup, a tech company. Maybe you might have a dry cleaners one day, but like you're not going to be able to do like, do you know what I mean?
But who's saying that stuff? You know, like so much of the startup industry gets its lessons from Silicon Valley, and people in Silicon Valley are people who had successful exits and now have an incentive to encourage entrepreneurship because that makes them richer, right? So people like Paul Graham, founder of Y Combinator, prolific investor, other VCs across the pond who are always talking about what you should do, what founders should do, etc. Absolutely, it makes sense for founders to do this when they're young. It also makes sense for investors to tell founders to do this when they're young because they've seen the template for success and it looks like people like Mark Zuckerberg or Alexis Ohanian and, you know, young computer science guys that go out there and build the next whatever. I do think that what is a real shame with this you know, Women's Reflections on her challenges is that that's exactly the kind of person we need to be entering this space, right?
Completely,
like,
yeah.
We've seen what people like Alexis Ohanian and Mark Zuckerberg can do, and that's great. But I haven't seen what single moms returning to work, returning to entrepreneurship can do. Mm. And that is, you know, that's the kind of innovation I'm curious about.
Are there VC funds out there that are actually making it easier for mothers to start companies? Like, do you have like childcare? Do you, do you know what I'm saying? There's a whole bunch of things you could imagine. I'm not a mother.
Yeah.
Or a parent. So it's hard for me to even imagine, but I can imagine there's a whole bunch of things that could be tailored towards founders who are coming from that background.
Yeah.
And because listen, there might be purely selfishly in a capitalistic way, there's billions of dollars of value there in the sense that, you know, parents and mothers can probably come up with products that can service their community and the wider world in general. That's,
yes.
And we're not having access to those ideas.
Yeah, it's crazy that we don't. I mean, there aren't even that many funds right now that are solely dedicated to women. I mean, more and more announced all the time. Mm. But I think it's going to take a long time for mindsets to shift, because even if we want to start a techish fund now, right, raise $10 million to invest in underrepresented founders, including single moms returning to entrepreneurship, let's say, we need to go out and convince other people that this fund is going to give them incredible returns, you know,
right.
The same kind of returns as funds that are just following the playbook that's been around for the last, you know, 40, 50 years that VC
right.
exists.
Yeah.
So I think this is an issue that ultimately is connected to feminism and dismantling patriarchy, because what we're trying to say is until we have gender equality, it's always going to be harder for women to just get, you know, get their due.
And is it similar to, you know, you often hear in the corporate world that as soon as like someone becomes a mother, essentially, that they're looked upon sideways, because like, well, you're not really going to work as hard anymore. You're
of
not
course.
Really going to prioritize.
And you're soft. You've gone soft.
Exactly, right. And that in entrepreneurship, it's even worse, where if a VC is trying to cut you a check, they want to know that you're going to be working 12 hours a day to get their money back, right? So if they're looking at a mother and they're thinking, oh, you know what, like, is she really going to put in those hours?
Mm.
And I don't think me personally, anybody should be putting in those hours full stop,
no.
right? But this is the expectation that, you know, a lot of these, I think it's a foolish expectation, but this is the one that they have. So that's another impediment.
Because, of course.
Yeah, so like, I think there has to be VC funds that are really specifically tailoring towards that. And I think there's nothing wrong with niches. I think great to have a VC fund targeting women, but can you have one where you're specifically saying, how do we make it sure that mothers who are blocked out, you know, have access? Because I think back to my mum, we talked about off mic, She never could. I mean, even if she wanted to, it was impossible. Like, she was there, single mom, two kids. Like, in what world was it feasible that she could go to somebody and say, give me a check to start something? Because they would have been like, no. Like, we're not accepting the fact that you've got to pick up your kids at three and cook lunch for your kids. It's just not happening. You've got to be there, you know, on call at all times. So anyways.
It's crazy. And I think, you know, bringing it back to gender equality and feminism, this is also why it's so important for companies to give parental leave, so that we as a society start to see the role of parenting as falling on both shoulders, because there are probably a lot of women going through their careers right now wrongfully being judged based on the company's expectation that they're going to be a mother, they're going to be a parent or whatever. Meanwhile, men are just progressing under the radar. For all you know, he wants to be a stay-at-home dad. But you're not judging him like that. You're not judging him like that. You're promoting him. You're giving him pay rises. Meanwhile, you're judging, you know, Cindy over there, because you assume things. And I think that's a big shift we need to go through as well. Hey everyone, that brings us to the end of another episode of Techish.
Aww.
So we'd love to hear from you. Use hashtag Techish on Twitter and let us know what you think. Don't forget, we're also on Patreon, patreon.com/techish.
See you soon. Ciao.